there was a group of us back in August in Pennsylvania that reached out to Pope Francis. We had written a letter requesting an audience. And, of course, we never heard back. And since that time, I've been planning for the possibility of a trip to Rome. And so when it was announced that he would be meeting with the heads of every bishop's conference in the world, it seemed to me like a logical place for me to be and to carry on the work that I'm doing here in Buffalo.
Now, given the security, just the everyday folks that come to visit Rome, and between that and between this bishop's summit itself, are you confident you can get somewhere close to the action, so to speak, and even just try to gain their attention right there?
I think the access is going to be provided by the press, frankly. It sounds as though the coverage, the level of coverage by media from around the world is akin to the election of a pope. And so all of the major networks are going to be there. And so you talk about security, and you talk about, if you want to talk about the normal mayhem of Rome, if you could even imagine the organized mayhem of that city, it will still be possible to walk into St. Peter's Square. I don't intend to protest or demonstrate publicly on Vatican property. I have that respect for them. But I certainly will make my presence known as appropriately as I can within proximity to these meetings. As we've demonstrated at the Catholic Center or at the Cathedral or other venues here in Buffalo, it'd be the same kind of thing, but certainly more at the home office, so to speak, and in a foreign country. But I'm confident. I'm very comfortable in Rome, and this will be my fourth time there. So I kind of have a sense of what I need to do and where I need to be.
Do you have anything already lined up with those said world media upon getting there?
No, nothing official. It's not like I'm trying to craft a media presence there. But I do anticipate some things that are going to be announced by the Vatican. We've already been told to have low expectations, but there will be plenty of things to respond to. And so I think having found a voice in this last year, very surprisingly to me, I've spoken with a lot of people in the media from Europe, from Chile, from Ireland, from Australia, in the wake of the Pennsylvania grand jury report. And so as some of them have kept contact with me, they've made it clear to me that it would be good to have my voice there. But that being said, there's going to be hundreds of people, advocates, victims, political leaders from all over the world that are expected to participate. And so my voice will be one of hundreds. I anticipate.
In recent days, the Pope admitted that, yes, abuses had occurred against nuns. Are you hopeful that he'll also just come out in the open and say the words, "We hurt children"?
There has to be an acknowledgement of not just the historical nature of this. We've had to force that out into the open. That is not something that the Church has communicated willingly. We've had to force them to talk about their history. The one thing that the Pope really has to say, that he has to acknowledge, that this is not simply a historical crisis or a historical phenomenon, that rather this is a systemic problem. This is almost, it seems, a constitutive element of the Church. It seems like it's in the DNA, that when you not just look at every age in the Church's history where they've had to respond to clergy sex abuse or the abuse of children, but it's from all kinds of different angles that we understand it now. that you're talking about children who haven't reached puberty. You talk about high school students, and now Pope Francis acknowledging that nuns were first, he said, sexually abused by priests or enslaved by priests in a sexual manner. He had to backtrack from that. He backpedaled from that when he said he meant more of an emotional type of manipulation. I think he just opened the door to something even bigger. What about the role of nuns as enablers of clergy sexual abuse? There were nuns all around me as Father Martin was molesting me, some of them in such close proximity that it would defy imagination to think that they didn't know. And I think that especially when you look at priests that are popular, or priests that have large parishes, they often have convents. And even today, you know, you might only have a one or two sisters living in a parish convent. That's how it is over here on the east side. What do they see? I mean, it's almost like that's a household unto itself, the father of the family and the sisters, and, you know, being such a part of the fabric of the parish. When the priest is doing something that criminal, how do they not have some awareness of it? I think the Pope inadvertently opened the door to that conversation this week.
Now, it's coming up on a year when you and Robert Hodson and Michael Whalen met a bunch of us out on Main Street, the 700 block. It's coming up on a year. Tell me just about how your life has changed with starting with Michael Whalen coming forward and saying, this happened to me, and then the bombshell, mm-hmm. Father Orsolitz confessing to Jay Tokas, mm-hmm. over at the news. Tell me how just life has changed for you over the past year now that this is being out in the open, and even you have said, I was abused.
Keep in the back of your mind that I've been thinking all of this time about my testimony before the grand jury in 2016. When Michael Whalen came forward so courageously on Main Street a year ago, I actually was not quite a part of that. I was too afraid to stand with them. And I stood a block away with my dog, just trying to look as normal as and inconspicuous as you can imagine. And it wasn't until you all were packing up that I went up and introduced myself to Michael. Now, Bob has been my advocate since I testified. But I didn't come forward in any sort of way until St. Patrick's Day, when the bishop had a mass at the cathedral. And that morning when I woke up, I knew I was going to stand with Bob, that I knew I was going to hold a sign. But in my mind, I had no intention whatsoever of speaking. And that day was the first day I ever said in public that I had been abused by Father, by a priest. I didn't even name him that day. It was that tentative. I really had no, when I look at what has changed since St. Patrick's Day, since, as you say, Michael Whalen and the Orsolitz revelations came forward, none of us could have expected, even knowing what I knew about the grand jury, even knowing what I knew about the history of this diocese in Buffalo, I never could have imagined that there would be so much of a light shone on this history and on the systematic nature of this in Buffalo. It's overwhelming.
You said that, you said you had testified in 2016?
That's correct.
And then it was finally 2018 that we, like you said, in March, that we got to meet you. So you were behind closed doors and told us stories. And that had to be, I can't quantify or find the words for what was probably going on in your mind, in your heart, for those 2 years in between the testimony. And then when Michael Whalen came forward, and then you decided to take your own step forward in March of last year.
When I first left ministry, I was in the throes of an alcoholic relapse, and it was out of that dramatic and clumsy and way of leaving ministry that I told the bishop in as direct terms as I could, Bishop Persico Aviri, that I was not coming back, that I saw no remedy for any of this. But I came to Buffalo, in a certain sense, relapsing and afraid, lost my livelihood, left my livelihood, left my community. And I came here in a huge state of despair, for the first year or so, and fear. I felt like I had to keep changing apartments because I was afraid. I finally settled back here after I testified. And it was that day in October, 2016, that everything changed for me. I finally felt I had a purpose. I finally felt that somebody had heard, somebody who really was in a position to do something listened. And that was the grand jury and the attorney general's staff in Pennsylvania. That was the turning point for me. And I was kind of busting at the seams from 2016 until, you know, even now. There's so much more I could say. But you're right that those couple of years after I testified, knowing what was going to be coming down the pike, it was even that was overwhelming. But I'd still say the Attorney General in Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, says frequently, we're in the third inning of a nine-inning series here. And I would say the same thing of Buffalo, even with hundreds of revelations now. I think we're probably about halfway there.
So this so-called tsunami may not even be the biggest of the storm?
Not by any stretch. If you look at the things that led to the resignation of Cardinal Law in Boston, or the shame that was brought upon Cardinal Mahoney in Los Angeles, Cardinal Regali in Philadelphia was forced to step aside over his cover-up. Bishop Malone has in his portfolio, his professional portfolio, every chapter of the Boston playbook, including a seminary that is tainted and priests who have been tainted by that seminary. And in real time, in these last few months, just the end of summer, came new revelations that he kept in ministry priests who were credibly accused. In my judgment, Dennis Ryder is credibly accused by three different victims, and he's still allowed to be a priest in Dunkirk. Anywhere else that would have led to the removal of a bishop, and that hasn't happened to Malone. Although if you apply justice evenly in the church, there's no logical reason for him to be in office. And so where that leads me back to Rome is, I think it's imperative for us to ask, does Francis even care? Does Pope Francis even care? When his predecessors, at least, as badly as they fumbled this, still had the presence of mind to remove cardinals. And here we have all these national and international voices just completely perplexed that Bishop Malone is in any kind of good standing. Makes a lot of us think that Pope Francis simply doesn't care.
Pope Francis, when he came into his position, was kind of hailed by many as more of a merciful pope, for no better way to describe it, liberal as opposed to his predecessors. If he doesn't, take that step forward, is there a sense that those that maybe kind of hailed him as kind of a breath of fresh air might be disappointed in him?
Styling himself as, first of all, I think he styles himself as a reformer. That's not necessarily how you started the question. that this notion that he's perceived as a liberal, I don't know that that's by his design, but that is the impression that I think a lot of us had from day one. And he still, from time to time, comes out with statements that seem very progressive. I don't think that those political terms of liberal or conservative mean anything to popes. I really don't. John Paul II was an economic liberal, and you know, for a socially conservative, as you might say. But what troubles me, what really concerns me about Francis, is that he did sort of build this, I'm going to say an artifice, like this kind of this facade of being a reformer. And 6 years in, we simply just don't see the evidence of it. He took a stab at reforming the Vatican Bank and then completely retreated to the same sorts of structures and oversight, such that European financial institutions don't regard the Vatican as being, you know, a trusted depository of funds. And who did he put at the head of the commission for that reform? It was Cardinal Pell, who, by all reports, has been convicted of child sex abuse himself. But even when he was laboring under those allegations, he was allowed to remain as one of the most important, for lack of a better word, department heads, probably the number three or four man at the Vatican, knowing what was being said about him in Australia. That suggests to me that, no, that isn't a reformist credential. And just having 2 years to prepare for the Pennsylvania report and to respond to it so ham-handedly. Yes, mistakes were made. Okay. what about zero tolerance? We can't keep talking about it without changing church law, without changing the operating policies of the church, its internal way of ordering itself. If he doesn't very soon and concretely with immediate results reverse course on the way that the church governs these issues, then it's not even his papacy that, you know, or his reputation that's at stake. I think it's a whole nother generation of Catholics that'll say, okay, we've had enough. And so I really do think that this is a reform moment. Some of the commentators say this is the biggest crisis of the church since the Protestant Reformation. I wholeheartedly agree with that. And it's a make or break moment for the church.